Yeah, this is meant to, this is the context menu key, you know, on Windows, but it, I instead went to the file menu. Instead of alt. Flexible password specification.
Slage codes and stuff rather than typing?
Slage cards?
No, little smart cards, basically.
Oh, yeah. Well,
predecessors to smart cards, something about half the size of a quarter-inch tape cartridge that you would shove into a slot, and it's very difficult to duplicate.
Okay, yeah. Well, basically, what this credentials interface is about... It's just that she didn't really explain it properly. You needed to new main domain password.
Straight into the fingers, there's no brain involved.
Exactly, exactly. Flexible network, better interfaces, and the last thing is a single context pointer.
The value to say, I am one of these, this is how you interpret me.
Actually, at this point, I really am going to have to just list the interface. Not too bad.
Lorikeet.
Yeah, Lorikeet is my repository of all sorts of interesting Samba-related, but not Samba, code.
Yep.
A few other
Samba fringe.
Yeah, basically. Like, a lot of it's our patches to other software.
Okay.
Here's
the patch to Windows 2000 to make such and such work.
No, no. It's patches like patches to Heimdall Kerberos. Patches to Cirrus Sassel. I had a patch to Triple PD in there.
Yep.
Let's just put it up somewhere.
Patches to FTP, and you'd let it use AD authentication and that sort of stuff.
If somebody wrote that patch and we were involved in it, I'd put it in Lorikeet. Doesn't have a web page or anything yet. It was originally intended to be, well, its purposes have been many and varied. It also holds my white papers.
And you're looking for a word, and there was a particular noisy Lorikeet around at the time?
Actually, it was the... I thought it would be a suitably meaningless name because we never come up. We always choose lame names.
Okay.
And something.
Well, someone had Parrot as a code name for the next Pearl, so I think Lorikeet is a code name for the next Samba fringe collection would be good.
So, this is what I was going to say about it. these guys will just take these C interfaces and understand them. I don't know how much I can fit on the slide.
Probably about three or four to go. Or three, given the size of the third paragraph.
Oh, I'll kill some of that.
And get out the big sword.
Yeah.
Your credentials, guess. Who's there?
Guess.
Well, but it literally does that, because we guess from the environment variables.
And yeah, it would do on a Unix system. Plus some Windows systems as well.
Well, in Windows systems, you've got an implicit set of... Oh, come on.
Edit paste.
I already did an edit copy, but Lix is being a pain.
Lix, is it?
Yeah. Copy.
Do a paste special. Paste as plain text, doesn't it?
Oh, fuck. You already did it.
Select all copy.
Yeah. Got a spare mouse? I'll get out more later.
That was a huge Kremlin mess.
Yeah,
it works. So nice. $20 one I got from Big W Stationery Department. And the other one that I've seen in Perth is Crazy Clats. Have a little mouse the same size for about $18. And the magic thing about them is they'll still operate reasonably on the arm of an aircraft seat.
Oh, beauty. So I think that might be a little much.
Yeah, certainly that font size. Be prepared to report. Page down, page down, page down.
Yeah.
It's still a... Oh, it's gone now.
So... Not too bad.
You can probably get rid of the various interfaces, yes?
Yeah, the star means things to this audience, which it doesn't to some others. I don't need to say about how it's... Da-dum-da-dum. So I don't need to... The constants don't make any sense.
Well, they do, because you can read them. You could guess and so on. You won't fit that fourth one on the slide meaningfully unless you drop all of the associated text. And you've got a back quote on the front of that, whereas you've been consistently using apostrophes for and after on the however.
It's because I have to in Lix, otherwise you get two.
Feeds.
It doesn't, yeah. Lix, because Lix goes to LaTeX, and you know LaTeX's behaviour with quotes.
No, I don't. I haven't used that very much.
So, yeah, it's a pain. I've got to do that. These bullet points got buggered up, but I'm just hoping if I go modify slide layout.
Looks like the sub-paragraphs have gone up two levels because the dot's smaller.
There's something really odd. Thank you.
apostrophe for ownership.
Oh, yeah.
But because the machine isn't a person, they're not worthy of having an apostrophe.
Okay. I thought you didn't use the apostrophe in its because that meant it was it is.
The apostrophe is for it is or an its of ownership.
I always got marked down for the its of ownership using the apostrophe. I was told I had to have its.
Yeah, if it's a machine or something like that, no apostrophe. If it's a person, and sometimes if it's a significant organisation, then there's an apostrophe.
In own, then it doesn't make you his.
Because the machine's not conscious, so it can't really have, it can't really own things.
But, okay,
you can understand why the Asians go nuts trying to learn the stupid language.
I had people dock me bloody marks for its when I'm talking about a person, except I probably was talking about computer things, so it didn't. Blah, I never learned English.
My mum was an English teacher, and I suffered a lot, but I've got most of it right.
Yes, yeah, such some tasks.
This is starting to look very gnome from the length of the symbols you're using.
I can just set machine account. It's already at 21 slides.
And counting, how many are you allowed?
Well, this I'm not going to tell you unless things happen. I mean, I am going to shove this in front of Stephen Hanley's nose and say I have written a presentation anyway.
Yes. You can always give a lunchtime presentation because the room's going to be unoccupied during lunch.
Why don't they allow lunchtime presentations?
There might be insurance complications or union complications or something, who knows, but you won't know until you ask.
Oh, well, I'll offer to do a lunchtime presentation on Samba Jensen. Somebody will then complain, well, how do I get lunch? But people are ducking now.
Scarf it in the 5 minutes between the end of the last session and this one. Well, yeah. The nice lady at the front hands the rolls around because there's too many rolls and not enough.
Well, yes, they seem to be dishing them out fairly well. I'd already had lunch.
It was like walking into a flock of seagulls.
Yes, you should see how there. That was a great run. Okay, so...
While you think about that, I'll go and get some fruit thinking about seagulls.
What else do you think I should say? What other things do you think I should...
Unexpected windfall, something?
Yeah,
I mean, Tridge has exemplified one, but surely you've had more than that, even in a limited time available.
That's the one. This is
improved
here
portability.
Is very recent.
Would it now be easier to write to make Samba for Windows more effective?
I need to say some more about Gen 6 here. Gen 6 success, choose the right interface. These belong on. The right interface belongs before the success. That then makes sense here.
Drag drop.
Don't worry, none of this will make any sense to you. But if you have a keen interest in Samba 4... Okay, just... Sorry?
So presumably one application could use Gen 6 to authenticate against 10?
Well, it would, to authenticate not, for example, Gen 6 in that case, it could be fine for a server, but because of the client, you might want to use Gen 6 to have dirty interfaces to using these protocols to talk to the Windows server that it has to talk to, because it just happens to be a network application.
Could use the protocols to talk to a not Windows server, but have the client program still under the impression that it was?
Yes. Yeah, that would be some of the interesting stuff. So I think we'll, seeing you've asked about it, let's make that a new slide.
How are you, Leon?
Yep.
I'm just Julian.
Cheese bit into one side.
I've seen you a few times at open source WA and all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
I was just speaking to, is it Mark, is that Phil?
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's right. And
he mentioned,
he gave me one of your
counsel. Yeah, okay. He mentioned you as the OSIA sort of...
You should, yeah.
OSIA issue.
The closest
guy.
Thing we can have to a local OSIA rep.
Terrific. Well, that said, and I've also spoken to Brendan about it. We'll put this on up or something. So get a bit of WA excitement underway.
Yeah.
Should be awesome.
Well, it'll help slipper in a way because the world will become a lot more focused on local stuff, which is what we should be.
GenSec
is a part of SAMBA 4, which is about providing basically, in the same way as Kerberos provides everything. You put in a username and password at one end and you get a network connection, a secured network connection. GenSec's about doing that for all of SAMBA and the myriad of interesting security protocols we have to implement.
Oh, okay. I bet it's exciting.
It's
up to speed with SAMBA 3 and Elder.
No, I'm doing stuff with SAMBA 4 game, trying to get the new release out.
Yeah,
so I build. That's what I build.
Yeah,
so,
right.
What's
your name, sorry?
Andrew Bartlett.
Andrew Bartlett, I know that name. Julian Coyne, how are you?
All right.
Oh, fantastic. So it's keeping you on your toes?
It does.
When are we expecting a stable release of SAMBA 4?
I don't know. We're not even at the guest stage.
Yeah.
Mostly because Trish
like
has been a little bit distracted for the last few weeks.
Oh, mate, I can't believe the drama that's going on there.
Yeah.
Like Manana, but without the same sense of urgency.
Look, I've got my electrical BSD again. I'm so happy. Everything's perfect. I bought this just on impulse because I was coming over here. I was at my wholesale and
I set up. Just happened to score perfectly.
I said one of them. And
it's a Lifebook, isn't there? Even good cheap.
Yeah, this was
for the brand.
Yeah, and it was reasonably, like, it wasn't the cheapest and nastiest thing there. And I said I'll have one of them, and absolutely every driver was just out of the box.
Yikes.
Beautiful. So,
how'd you manage that?
What model number is it, one?
Isn't it nice? And it's
BSD.
Nice.
Just have a look at the badge on the
right. S7010, I think. Yeah, it's an S7.
How much
does it set
you back?
Oh, about 2.6 wholesale, so that's about 20% off retail. If you want one, go to West Ham and give me
about 1,200.
What's that?
Pixels, 1,100.
I don't even know, 1280, 1024.
And,
this is running SAMBA 3 and other facts and all sorts of fun little things.
That's the other question. Beth, you like how long does it last before it goes blank?
Bloody awesome. It lasts, that's a full brightness. If I take that down, it lasted me about 6 hours the other day.
Mm-hmm.
7 hours.
My little clunker sitting at the back there.
Yeah.
At the time I bought it was only $100, but it was a few years ago.
Scheduled for a replacement.
And that lasted 3.5 hours when I first got
really?
It.
Really?
Yeah, it's now down to only 1.25.
Bloody hell, that's awesome. For
an $1,800 lap, it was the second cheapest one I could buy.
Wow.
And it had twice the memory, 10 gig more hard disk, and slightly faster processor and a few other things than the cheapest one.
Yep.
And it was a slightly more reputable brand. It's an open book,
Yeah, yeah. DMA are the purveyors of them, I think.
We're at the time.
Yeah.
And now, it's Adrian Ciao, isn't it?
What's that?
DMA. West Ham.
West Ham, yes.
Adrian Ciao?
Aaron.
Aaron Ciao.
Aaron Ciao, yeah.
I thought there was something wrong. Now Aaron can give me an equivalent laptop for about $1,300.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, he's a nice guy, except that I procured two laptops for, just as a favour to him the other week. He goes, oh, this one's come in XDemo.
I put it out and it was just rooted. I've never seen a piece of hardware just so flaky. Like, it had just not pick up the hard disk sometimes when you boot it and everything.
Oh, goodness me.
And so I R8'd it, and it's taken, you know, because it was a mate kind of thing,
yep.
3 bloody weeks of client spinning chips.
Imagine
I just
so.
Jumped on a plane. Not really. I'm not that much of a friend. Yeah, but even the Centrino Wireless.
And there's NetBeast too, right? NetBeast too?
FreeBSD.
I suppose I need to move on so we can see if have people coming back for this
presentation. Just start and see if we have a notice.
So GenSec's what I need to be skilling up in, is it?
No, GenSec's an internal layer within Samba, which would be interesting to the developer geeks.
About as far into Samba as I get is root
my
exec and post exec.
Might make a difference, but I suppose I just...
We'll give the nice man.
Thank you.
So, I thought we'd just start a presentation on the units of Samba 4 and see if anyone in the audience knows.
The government delegates.
I'm going to wander off to a corner, and this will be an interesting talk for Samba XP, I think.
Are you here for the rest of the week?
Yep, up until Sunday evening.
So
if you're going to be here on Sunday, that's probably the best day to head again, because this will all be finished.
Yeah, that'll be awesome. I'm going to go to the...
So, 25 slides so far.
The best place for it, I think they've got the little green beast on top of the stick and all.
Absolutely.
Actually, I'll be going to do that as well.
Okay, welcome back.
The queue, desperate queue for the last cup of coffee is out there, so we'll let them come in as they return. One minor bit of housekeeping before we get stuck into this afternoon. In your delegate packs that you picked up when you arrived, there's an evaluation form. If you're anything like me in office, you could probably play a good game of Where's Wally to find out where you left your delegate pack or that evaluation form. If you have it, or even if you don't, there are spares out front. The important thing is if you could fill in your evaluation form and drop them in the box out front or hand them to myself or Lindsay or Gordon in time. Now, to the business of this afternoon. I laughed out loud when I read the title of Ian's presentation. I really like it. Ian Oye is special counsel for Blake Dawson Morgan. I won't try and tell you the legal gymnastics that Ian goes through on behalf of organisations concerning open source because I'll get it wrong. All I'll say is that he's been a big champion of open source for quite some time, and I'm very pleased to introduce him to you. So, ladies and gentlemen, here you are.
Okay. A slightly intriguing title, hopefully, and that's partly because I've been reconfiguring this presentation throughout this conference to try and dodge other people's material. So forgive me if some of it's repetitive from things you might have heard, might be repackaged. But the particular spin that I wanted to put on my presentation, which I don't think might have been covered in previous presentations in this conference, arises out of a particular situation. And the situation where a government agency doesn't realize it's embarking on an open source project or a project that might be susceptible to open source treatment, and then for whatever reason gets to the middle or the end of the project and then decides, well, maybe we can open source it. So there are a couple of considerations arising out of that scenario. It arises out of work that we actually did for an agency in this situation. And so the material that's covered in here is basically material that is intended to be practical and applicable to a government agency in the same kind of situation. So what I'm going to cover is basically four kinds of things. Perspective and context, I've already given you some of that. I will then cover some of the background considerations and then the dimensions of a treatment for software outputs of a government project, if you're going to deal with them in an open source way as a government agency. And then cover some of the options that we identified as part of our consultancy and our work as being the kind of paradigms. And there are about five or six kind of paradigm situations that you can conceive of as options for the treatment. And mostly they involve combinations of whether, importantly, you have a release partner involved, whether the government agency chooses to involve a third party, another agency, another entity, in the open source treatment. So, as I said, this presentation comes out of some work that my firm, Blake Dawson Waldron, particularly myself and my colleague Emma Hatcher, did with Acumen Alliance, particularly Bede Webster, in relation to consulting on an agency in this particular situation, where what they were considering was they were looking at the informational outputs, the project outputs, the technology outputs of their programs and projects, and realizing they had a whole bunch of digital, they had a whole bunch of orphans. They had the outputs and deliverables of projects that once the funding had finished, once the stakeholders had been satisfied that the immediate project outcomes had been delivered, or even if the project, say the project had been canned, but had been 60, 70%, 80% accomplished. Nonetheless, there were outputs, which it would be a real shame from that agency's point of view for them to simply just disappear, to be orphaned, and the public money that had been spent on them would be dissipated and wasted. And in this situation, they had the idea of thinking, well, what about open source? What about trying to bring this into either an existing open source community or creating one or help fostering one? So specifically, this issue of orphaned outputs is related to the question of digital amnesia. And the example is where this agency had identified that 4 or 5 years ago, they had paid a contractor to actually develop a specification or for a standard, a technical standard. They had been very happy with the work, but that project finished. They published that material on the internet, on their website, or through hard copies that were distributed. And then 3 years later, well, nothing happened in 3 years, but 3 years later they realized, well, our initiatives, our policy has actually caught up with the work that we did earlier. Perhaps it's time to go and build on it. And guess what? No one could find it. It disappeared off the website. The agency had gone through several reorganizations in the meantime, and the website itself had gone through reorganizations. No one had actually archived the material or actually... And importantly, not only from the department's point of view, the agency's point of view, nothing had been done, but no one in the wider community had actually taken it up either. No one had noticed. And here they were in a digital amnesia situation. The work was wasted from that point of view. So, particular issues then. Because this agency, in this kind of situation, realized they didn't actually have a framework for deciding what to do with this stuff. Being a government agency, it was important for them to ensure that all the right processes were covered and that all the right relevant considerations were taken into account. And even though they were really conducive towards an open source treatment, nonetheless, that treatment had to be put in a context. And it had to be put in a context of a decisional framework that made sense. So that was the first question. How can they assess the suitability of the project outputs for an open source treatment? The second issue is then, well, we don't necessarily have the resources to do everything ourselves. And because a lot of the time we're talking about the end of project or a project that is really mature, the funding for it is fairly well established and been allocated, well, we don't actually have necessarily the resources ourselves immediately to actually take on this open source and open source treatment. So we might need to get a partner involved, a release partner. How do we build this into that framework? Because the question is not divorced from a decisional point of view. Not only do we, if we decide to take an open source type treatment, we also need to ensure that it is actually effective, that it can be implemented, and if we need to have a release partner involved in the process, that is part, an integral part of that decision process. So, those are the two main questions. Well, now, you will realize from what I'm saying that the thrust, therefore, of this presentation and the material here is primarily towards government as a developer, as a supplier, as a distributor, not as a procurer or sourcing open source inputs for its own purposes. And it, moreover, we're talking about situations where the agency may very well not have even considered open source when they started the project. It's just that open source becomes one of the possible solutions down the track. Moreover, this presentation predominantly is talking about Australian government Commonwealth agency considerations, although the framework that I'm going to present on can be adapted for basically any government agency, but the details of it, when you start talking about particular statutory responsibilities and accountability responsibilities, I'm really only going to be talking about it at the Commonwealth level. Lastly, it's important to actually appreciate that from an agency point of view, from a project or program point of view, these outputs are not restricted necessarily only to software. And this is an important point, because it may very well be that there are non-software outputs that need to be treated in exactly the same way by the agency, which means that the decision-making that in this case, when we probed a bit further, really had to encompass not just open source software considerations, but larger public information, information management, information dissemination issues, which are not necessarily the same as those of the open source community. And so we're talking about things like freeware as opposed to open sourceware. We're talking about potentially open content that is not necessarily software derived. We're talking about potentially dedicating things to the public domain as opposed to maintaining control in an open source way. We're talking about potentially partially open domains, partial commons or community commonses that are not necessarily as open as those that the open source community typically would consider as being the paradigm. And we're talking about them, these kinds of alternatives for public licensing in the context of a government agency that recognizes that open source is one potential answer, but not the only answer to meet its imperatives as a government agency with government outcomes. Okay, talking about background considerations. So this is the first part of the framework. This is the hygiene factors. This is the environment. What are the kinds of things that an agency would have to consider before it started thinking about a software treatment decision, whether it was open source or not? And so we kind of categorize them under a couple of categories up there. And some of these categories overlap. I appreciate that. But nonetheless, you've got to start somewhere. And so it's a good way of starting to get a handle on the issues from an agency point of view, for a program manager's point of view. Break it down into something that's manageable in bite-sized pieces. So going through each of those quite specifically. First thing, talking at the project level. When the project manager or program manager is looking at whether to subject the software to an open source treatment, the kinds of considerations they have to bear in mind are, firstly, the project. Well, what's the project objectives, success criteria, both immediate, medium-term, long-term, and where are they at that stage when they are considering an open source treatment? Now, the context of where the question came up, or when the agency realized they had an issue, was in relation to projects that were fairly well mature. But having interrogated the projects in question and looked around, it's obvious to everyone that the earlier that you consider within the project the possibility of an open source treatment, the better. Now, I say consider because you may very well decide early on in a project that it's too early to decide. We can't really decide whether, at this point, whether an open source solution is really the answer, or it may be one of the options we have to keep open. And then you revisit that through the project. I mean, and you also align your project criteria to this possibility of an open source solution, because this is one of the things that with a fairly mature project, it was fairly accidental that there was an alignment between the project's outcomes and objectives and open source treatment. It's basically an accident. If those things were actually integrated at an earlier point of the project as a possibility, that open source treatment was a possibility, then there would have been a greater cohesion, a better and more efficient decision making. I won't belabor the project's legal framework as a consideration, as a background, but suffice to say there may be things within the contractual relations that set up the project or the funding arrangements that set up the project that either enable or inhibit an open source treatment. And significant, of course, is the question of whether there are any open source inputs into the project in the first place, because those will help structure what comes up. Logistical challenges in dealing with an alternative software IP treatment to what was originally envisaged is a particular problem with fairly mature projects. If you're going steering down one kind of assumption without, and a lot of the projects kind of assumed that some kind of proprietary treatment might very well happen, and then they suddenly think about, oh, actually, this project might benefit from an open source treatment. Changing courses meant that there had to be a whole lot of backtracking in terms of due diligence, working out, well, is this actually possible? Financial implications, resources, I won't belabor those. Technical limitations, ditto, more than can be said about that. Importantly, stakeholders and who are involved in the project. In a government project, typically speaking, there will be non-governmental stakeholders as well as governmental stakeholders from other agencies. And it's important that if you're going to start putting an open source solution on the table, that's put on as early as possible as an option to make sure everyone's on the same page. A lot of this sounds like common sense, but it's actually these are the practical things that we found were practical disinhibitors to or inhibitors to an open source treatment, because there wasn't sufficient early stakeholder involvement in the possibility of an open source solution. Okay, moving from the project to the agency level. Obviously, there's going to be alignment with the agency policy, and not only alignment, but obviously conformity with the agency's policy. And two particular areas, I mean, there are obviously many others that could be of relevance. The first is a vendor engagement and management policy. A lot of agencies do have that kind of policy. And particularly in the light of the Commonwealth Procurement Guidelines, there will be agency implementations of how they procure and select and qualify vendors. That's important because you start thinking of the question of release partners. Because the procurement of a release partner or the qualification of a release partner could potentially involve a procurement of some kind, whether you get a consultancy contract to try before you buy with a particular release partner, or you go through a tender process to go and find someone out there who is actually going to be able to assist you with an open source treatment. Apart from vendor engagement and management, there's the issue of intellectual property management. And again, looking at this from an agency perspective, it's the usual kind of stuff that an agency should be doing, query whether they are doing. In general, in relation to their intellectual property, you've got to identify, make sure you keep track of it, inventory it, make sure you assess its value, its significance, and what risks are involved in the management, how much the costs are of that. You've got to track its use and also be accountable for its use. And at the end of the day, you might very well have to ensure that you dispose of it in the right way. So, moving to the whole of government, so we've talked about the project characteristics, we talked about the agency background situations, and now we get into the whole government situation. And here again, I'm talking about Australian government. And forgive the very small writing, but there is a lot of stuff in this area. I'm not going to cover all of it. But these are some headings that became relevant and are relevant. Firstly, there's a framework, a legislative framework for the management of public monies and public property. And I talk about those two things differently, separately, because with public money, you've got to use it efficiently, effectively, and ethically if you're an agency that's covered by the FMA Act, and you've got comparable responsibilities under the CAC Act. But the interesting thing about the responsibility under to use public money properly is the ethical dimension. Most people in this room might very well assume that an open source software treatment or solution for a government output of a project is ethical use of the public money that public money involved in that treatment. But it's not necessarily the case. One actually has to consider that. I'll talk a bit more about public property a bit in the next slide. But that's the first area, management of public monies and public property. And there's a whole bunch of guidelines, including the AGMO procurement guide and the AGMO open source software guide. Second area, ICT development policy of government. That keeps changing, but it's relevant. The Commonwealth IT/IP guidelines are also relevant in this context. And again, those are under review. Keep your eye on that. There are other government policies for local ICT development that have to be borne in mind. IP risk and security management policy, I won't dwell on that. The AGMO guide does cover a lot of those considerations. And finally, one area that people don't necessarily think about, but is relevant when you're thinking about release partners, is government policy on a whole government basis regarding government contracting on an alliance basis or with public-private partnerships or those kinds of public-private initiatives, because there is guidance regarding this, and particularly when money is involved, there are principles that have to be borne in mind. So that's part of the minefield from a whole government basis. Now, focusing specifically on the area of financial management and accountability for software IP, I'm just going to go and highlight three things that have to be borne in mind. The first is accounting. Now, I'm not an accountant, but there is an increased focus within Australian government agencies and from a whole government perspective being filtered down now on accounting for intangible assets such as IP, particularly its valuation and the basis for valuation. Previously, traditionally, government agencies value their IP based on cost or deemed cost of production. Under the new accounting standards, that's no longer appropriate. You have to look at the liquid and active markets for that IP. It becomes even more problematic when you have to consider open source software in that market or assets that are potentially to be open source software and value them in that context. Secondly, I've already talked about Section 47 of the FMA Act, which talked about proper use of public monies, meaning including ethical use of public monies. Another section that should be borne in mind, particularly when you're thinking about open source software, is Section 43 of the FMA. And this is an interesting section that talks about public property. And what it says is basically that it's a criminal offence for a government official, and it's punishable by 7 years imprisonment, for an official to make a gift of public property, unless the making of the gift is expressly authorised by law, or the finance minister has given written approval for the gift, or the Commonwealth acquired the property to use it as a gift. Now, think about this in the context of open source software. If the software is only being licensed out by government, then usually you wouldn't think of that as the government giving anything away. It still owns the thing. It's just allowing everybody else to use it. So technically speaking, you might say, well, there is no gift, so, you know, an official doesn't have to worry about Section 43. On the other hand, if you're thinking about making an effective open source software solution, you may very well have to transfer ownership or grant exclusive licenses or exclusive control to a release partner, because they might be the best person to actually implement an open source software solution. And if you actually acquired it in the first place as government, and then you're thinking midstream of then implementing this open source software solution, you actually have to consider ensuring that what you're doing is not making a gift of public property in this case. Otherwise, the section will be triggered. Again, it's mostly a problem where you didn't acquire the property in the first place for use as open source software. It's more a problem where in the middle of the project you decide to change stream. Moral of that story, make your decisions fairly early on in terms of deciding whether open source is a possible solution. Last particular issue regarding financial management accountability that I will mention is the degree of entrepreneurship that is appropriate for that agency. When I say appropriate, I mean not just from a policy point of view, whether they want to do it, but also, well, can they do it? Or should they really do it, given their statutory responsibilities? There was a little bit of talk earlier on by other speakers regarding commercialization in the context of open source. And I would echo one of the other speakers in saying that, by and large, when we came to considering this issue from a program perspective, commercialization imperatives they weren't an imperative. The issue was, well, if we didn't do something with this stuff, then it would go to waste. And so making money out of the solution really wasn't a government agenda item in that sense. Commercialization, as we'll come to see, became relevant when we started thinking of the best way of achieving the agency's outcomes through an open source or open source-like solution. But commercializing and making money from it wasn't a consideration. Okay, market conditions. Now, this is important as a background consideration before as a project manager if you were thinking about switching streams. Because if there was no market out there at the end of the day, there was no point in trying to go and promote this as open source software. And this here is actually important to consider. There are several markets involved. You know, there may be more than these ones, but these are the three key kinds of markets that we were thinking about. The first is the market of potential users of the software IP when it's being promoted through a release treatment. Secondly, there's a market for developers or suppliers, people who will take it up and keep redeveloping, keep reusing it, repackaging, redistributing it, apart from users. And then thirdly and importantly, a separate market of people who may be release partners. And these release partners may be people who are not users directly and not developers directly, but other people interested. And this is when we're looking at the projects in question, there were these kinds of stakeholders out there, people who weren't users or developers, who were interested in promoting the project, promoting its outcomes, and interested in doing it from an open source way. And it's important to consider the market for those kinds of people as well. Importantly, that market is not limited to people in Australia. A lot of the initiatives that government programs that we and projects we have in Australia have a worldwide impact potentially, and Australia is a leader in many of those projects. That potentially means that there are release partners out there who are not in Australia. Coincidentally, that is actually quite consistent with the Commonwealth Procurement Guidelines, post-USFTA, which embodies the principle of non-discrimination. Basically, government agencies that are governed by the Commonwealth Procurement Guidelines cannot discriminate on the basis of geography or locality. They should be picking the best of breed wherever they are. And so that's an important consideration. Of course, there's some practical challenges involved when you know that the best, or you think you know, that the best people to do this job are the people who are literally or metaphorically sitting next to you as opposed to all over the world, and trying to qualify the release partner in an effective and cost-efficient way whilst complying with those non-discrimination rules can be a challenge. Okay, just two other issues, which I put on the same slide. That's not to say they're not important, but there's not much I want to say about them right now. As a background consideration, we've already talked about other stakeholders that may be involved in the project before you start trying to change it midstream. And you can kind of classify them into three categories. Well, maybe think of some more, but I thought of them in three. Firstly, there are stakeholders who are acting in the role potentially of blockers. They can block the treatment, either because they are a proprietary vendor who is already involved in the project, an incumbent, someone with a vested interest, or simply someone who doesn't understand what you're trying to do or has a different agenda. Secondly, there are enablers. They are people who are sympathetic to the cause. They might not necessarily understand your cause or whether if you wanted to make an open source treatment, but they won't put roadblocks in your way. They may be a bit of education, but cooperation may be where they fall. And thirdly, of course, they are obligers. Given the nature of the open source community and out there, there are a lot of people who actually do get involved in government projects who actually wish to have contractual obligations for things to be put into public domain or made open source and so on and so forth. They may very well be stakeholders that are pushing an agenda from that point of view. My only comment on observation in context of all that is, as a program manager, as a project manager, it's important to stick to your own agenda of your own stakeholder and pay attention to certainly the other stakeholders, but the decisional framework certainly means that you are making a decision for your own stakeholder, not others. And I won't dwell on the OSS unique issues that may arise. There'll be plenty of opportunity in the legal discussion to talk about legal stuff on that, and there's also probably already been some discussion. But bear in mind that to the extent that the project touches on established communities of open source practice, established open source communities, they are an important consideration that should be built in, because they may very well help the cause. Okay. We've talked about background considerations. That's the map of the lay of the land before you even start thinking about what you do. Once you start thinking of what you do, there are a couple more issues that then become relevant to the decision, and you build them into thinking about what the options are. And I'll step through these fairly quickly because they're fairly general ones. The first is perceived value of the IP, and it's kind of an overarching one. What do I mean when I say value? In this context, I'm talking about utility, really. How potentially useful is this stuff going to be? And what is the perceived value, utility, usefulness of this from the government agency's point of view? And that's relevant because if it's not worth anything from that point of view, from the government agency's point of view, then why should it put itself out to actually put in place an open source solution, as opposed to just letting this orphan work lie there and be orphaned and forgotten in the midst of time? So the overarching criteria for successful treatment from this point of view is whether there will be a use or continued development and distribution of a software IP outside the agency and beyond the project from which it originates. So it acquires a life of its own. And importantly, this of course has to be aligned with the project outcomes. I'm making an assumption here that the project actually has an intended outcome beyond the project or the agency. So, you say it's difficult to justify treating software IP as open source if you cannot justify that there is a perceived value to this output. Now, for those in the room from vendor land, this is probably stuff that you would consider in your product development anyway. But from a project manager or product manager's point of view, it's not from a project manager or program manager's point of view, government personnel, it's not necessarily intuitive. And that is to say that it's important to gauge at what stage this output is before you want to let it out. Has it already been prototyped? Has it been proven in some way, in some implementation, or in some form? Even if it has been prototyped, does it actually require some further technical work or product development to actually get it to a state that's ready for market? Even if it satisfies those product criteria, does it require basically a communication strategy or someone to push that or a sales and marketing strategy support or someone to invest in actually getting it out there? Does it already have a mature presence in the market going through? Or alternatively, is it at the end of its life cycle in this iteration, in this particular form? Because all of those things will obviously be relevant to the suitability of this output for an open source treatment. The third kind of consideration of treatment dimension that is, and this is actually the most important one in some respects, is the degree to which the agency wants to stay involved after the output is put into an open source solution. And an agency's involvement continuing may, on the one hand, may wholly retain responsibility, so no partners, you take it on yourself in-house to promote and continue to develop and support that open source treatment. A mixture of retained transferred responsibilities to a release partner, or alternatively a full transfer of responsibility for open source treatment to a third party, a second party. Now, all of that, of course, affects the risk and reward allocation between the parties. When I say reward, well, for the government agency, I'm really talking about reward in non-tangible sense, because most of the time, the most that would be considered would be a cost recovery. And if there was a commercialization aspect, well, you probably aren't talking about an open source treatment in the first place. And, of course, the degree of agency involvement affects the risks involved and the effect, and also the complexity. And those are really the two of the key determinants. And I'll present on that a little bit later on this. Okay, moving on, the mode of treatment. When we talk about mode of treatment, I'm really talking about the kind of licensing that we're going to use, or the kind of distribution model and exploitation model. And again, I'm not going to dwell on that. Suffice to say that open source solutions, such as the ones that Brendan had covered, are at one of the end of the spectrum, and they certainly should be within the range of possibilities, but they are certainly more traditional models of distribution and exploitation. Types of IP, I've already covered this really. We're talking about potentially not just software IP, but also other materials such as documentation, whether it's content within the software deliverable or technical documentation.